All of the government programs that we don't like are funded by theft. All of the government programs that we do like... Oh, sorry, there aren't any. Government is the reason that healthcare is expensive. Government is the reason you can't go to college. Taxation is theft.
And welcome back. Taxation is theft. And this is the show that talks about all the ways the government is ripping you off and stealing from you in the form of taxes and lots of other things. I'm Dan, Taxationist Theft Berman, coming to you live on Facebook and YouTube from an underground bunker deep within the jungles of Mexico. Former candidate for President of the United States, currently in the race for Governor of Texas. And today I've got a really amazing guest with me, Matt Sands. He is the founder of the Nations of Sanity Project, which is really amazing. If you hate the government, or if you think the government can do better, or you think our societal process of law can be better than what we have, this is definitely going to be a really interesting talk. But of course, before we get started, if you're watching the live streams right now on Facebook or YouTube, go ahead and share, like and share and comment. Get your friends to come and watch. Start a watch party. Let's get a lot of people, because this is going to be some really great information today, and we want as many people to hear this as possible. Also, when the show's over, make sure you head over to taxationistheft.info, and you can help support us, anything you buy from that website, and we've got some really amazing stuff. We've got these awesome Taxationist Theft hats, Taxationist Theft flags, all kinds of really cool stuff, and everything you purchase helps go to fund our efforts to spread Taxationist Theft counter-propaganda around the world to help stop government oppression. And we also have lots of extra content on YouTube, so make sure you head over there and subscribe and catch all of our really awesome videos that are there. But enough of that for now. On to the show. Matt, how's it going?
Yeah, great. Hi, Don.
Awesome. Hey. So we talked a couple weeks ago, and I really got to hear a lot about your this idea that you have. And it's really amazing. It challenges, I think, the way that we see kind of what the law is. Because even so, like, to most people, it's like, oh, the law is whatever those politicians write on paper. Then you have some people who are more like anarchists and voluntarists who say, no, the law is natural law, and those bureaucrats don't really matter. But there's still some confusion about what that natural law could mean. And I think you kind of address that with this idea that you have, where we can kind of come up with something that we can agree on as a law, but it fits within this non-aggression principle. So I'm probably totally just misrepresenting this. So I'm gonna let you explain it and kick this off.
Okay, yeah, thanks, Dan, for taking the time to chat with me about this. Basically, the Project Nations of Sanity is built on the assertion that the only way to create a truly free society with truly equal rights is to establish the non-aggression principle as the law through a peace agreement. And specifically, we actually present a three-part peace agreement, which represents the three dimensions that are required to actually apply the law in the real world, to actually establish it in the real world. And just to quickly go through those parts, it's like part one is just the basic agreement to establish the non-aggression principles of the law. Part two is what I call the lines in the sand, where we set limits of tolerance over differing interpretations. And then part three is about rightful ownership, where we basically ratify rightful ownership using the non-aggression principle. And just to go back to part two, because that's, I think, the most important part of the three parts, is what that's about. That's setting the lines in the sand, because there's obviously the non-aggression principle itself is relatively clear as a principle, but there are certain sort of fuzzy edges and gray areas where, like, reasonable people can disagree about precisely where you draw the line. And what we're doing with part two is we're basically acknowledging that, but we're saying, okay, well, that's fine, we can have the gray areas where reasonable people can agree to disagree. And we can't really enforce that as a universal law because it is a grey area. But there's a limit to the grey area. There's a limit to the different interpretations that we can tolerate. There is a line that we need to draw where it's black and white that you're definitely violating the non-aggression principle. And that would be when this universal law would apply. And then upon that framework, we can still have voluntary collectives and societies that establish their own rules that go beyond that. But those rules would only apply to people that agree to be part of those collectives. Whereas this universal law, this is a way of establishing the law, you know, like I say, universally. So we have this universal definition of crime. So no matter who you are, no matter what you've agreed to, that law could be enforced on you. I hope that makes sense.
Right. Yeah. And it's, I mean, so it sounds very much like the natural law or the non-aggression principle. Only to clarify a little bit more, but I guess, and this is something we didn't talk about last time. So what, because you call it an agreement, is like, I don't know, like the first thing that comes to mind is, okay, if this is some like worldwide agreement, like I'm like picturing like the people at the UN, like representatives of each nation signing agreements on behalf of us, which of course violates the non-aggression principle. What do you envision as like, how would this actually be implemented?
Well, I mean, the purpose of the agreement is just as a kind of vehicle for establishing the law, because the problem is currently our laws, as you said before, are established through governments. They are whatever the government says. So like the laws that exist today, they're laws because we have a ruling authority that says, you know, these are the rules and these are the laws. And what we're saying is when no one has the right to create laws, they shouldn't be created on the whim of any ruling authority. They need to be based on this principle. So the only way to establish the non-aggression principle as the law would be through a peace agreement, because obviously if you did it through a ruling authority, you'd be contradicting yourself because ruling authorities violate the non-aggression principle. So it's really about having this kind of like a peace treaty, basically, where we're kind of declaring as a society that these are the universal terms of peace. Now, I say agreement because that's obviously how we establish it. But the important thing about this law is it would apply to everybody, whether they agree to it or not. Because, and this is kind of like my whole thing about making the non-aggression principle the law, the beauty of the non-aggression principle is that enforcing it is by definition defensive. There's no violation of rights or violation of freedom required to enforce the non-aggression principle's law. So anyone who says, well, I didn't agree to that law, why should it apply to me? You don't need to agree to it, because it's just a basic principle that if you violate it, you're attacking someone. Therefore, any force used against you is justified as defensive force. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and that's really interesting, because it's, you know, like if somebody comes up to you and, you know, they point a gun at you and they say, I want your watch. If, you know, you don't, if you live by the non-aggression principle, that's a crime against you. You can defend yourself against this person. Now, under, like, even if they, you know, they never agreed to that, well, okay, that's fine. You never agreed to any condition where they would come and be able to take your watch from you. But even if they have a different government system, and most government systems would not allow this either, then they're under that system by force. But even if they had, and I would say that arguably this is exactly what the government does. If they say, no, I live in a different system and our system allows us to steal from you because you're a different class of person or not one of us or something, that's really something the government would do. You know, like where they say like, you're there enjoying your life, conducting business. We want 25% of the profit. These are our rules and we're going to enforce those on you. So, it really is kind of like, I almost want to call it a paradox, but it's not. You're not enforcing the laws on anybody. You're really just like, just, you know, it's kind of like gloves off at that point. There are no rules. And as long as you stick by your, you know, you didn't become offensive and start an attack on somebody until they initiated that aggression against you, there is no real system that defines you as the criminal, except for the person who initiated the aggression. And of course, the danger with that is if that person, so let's say, for example, the IRS comes to you and says, hey, you know, give us your money. You know, you could rightfully defend yourself. But of course, the IRS has a much like, you know, hey, well, yeah, you can attack us, but we've got a huge group of friends who outnumber you. So but it's like at that point, it kind of comes down to, you know, whoever's got the most guns makes the rules. And that's, you know, I think most rational people would agree that that's not the right way to run a society, even though they kind of cave into that all this, you know, they come up with like all these illusions and excuses that they make up to kind of comfort themselves that's not the system that they live in, even though it is.
I mean, the thing is, it really comes down to morality. And even though we've all got our own different kind of subject moralities, there is an objective standard of morality that we can find, which I would argue is the non-aggression principle. But I mean, the way I kind of approach it to people when they kind of talk along those lines about, like, you know, well, the government does this and that. I mean, the difference between the laws, I mean, this is, I suppose, what I want to do with the law is I want to take it from what it currently is, which is just the arbitrary dictates of a ruling authority, and put it to what it should be, which is, like I say, an objective definition of what is crime. And it's like what we have now, we have like might makes right. And there's like this pretense of morality underneath it. But ultimately, it is, as you say, it's might makes right. If you don't pay your taxes, that you would be morally right not to pay your taxes, and you'd be morally right to use force to defend yourself from the IRS and the police and whatever other government agencies came to try to rob you. But whether you're morally right or not doesn't help you out if you're outgunned, right? You know, so but the thing is, we want to say to people, okay, well, do you want that society? Do you want might makes right? Because if you want might makes right, then you're just basically getting rid of morality, and you're saying, okay, well, we're going, what, you know, what might makes right, that's basically the same as no morality at all, or moral relativism or something like that. So I'm basically saying, you know, because the point I make about morality is morality itself is not objective. You could reject it. You can say, okay, I don't believe in morality. There's no argument someone could make to me that gets me from a is to an ought in regards to this fact makes this should this moral claim objectively true. So people can reject morality and they can have the might makes right thing, but as you say, if they do that, then they've got no complaint against any force used against them. Whereas if they do want to accept morality, I would say that the only way morality works as a moral framework is if you base it on the concept of self-ownership. So people have a choice. They can either reject or accept the concept of self-ownership, which is nothing more than the idea that everyone has right over only their own selves. And I don't really see how people can argue against that, because if you don't have right over yourself, and like if someone says, oh, I don't believe in self-ownership, that you don't have right over yourself, I have right over you. Well, it's like, well, where does their right over you come from if they don't even have right over themselves? You know, so the only way morality can have any kind of consistent foundation is if it's built on self-ownership. And once we accept the concept of self-ownership, then the non-aggression principle is like self-evident from that concept. Like if you accept self-ownership as a moral truth, then you can't then say that the non-aggression principle is not a moral truth, because all the non-aggression principle is the moral principle of self-ownership. If you have right over only yourself, then obviously it's wrong for anyone to violate that. Any aggression against you, ruling you, enslaving you, you know, all of that. So,
right.
So when you look at it in that way, the whole thing has a kind of objective truth to it. So like, you know, the difference is law right now is just whatever our ruling authority says it is, which basically makes it arbitrary. Whereas this idea is to say, okay, well, what we're doing is we're just accepting this one moral truth, which is that everybody has right over only their own selves. And once we accept that, then the non-aggression principle becomes an objective standard of morality that defines crime in a universal way. And then we're saying this is the law, not because I said so or you said so, but just because this basic principle of self-ownership says so. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And it's there's a couple of interesting points I want to go back to. You know, one is, you know, you make a really good point. If you don't own yourself, if somebody else has the ability to own you, even if it's not, you know, not actual ownership like slavery, but, you know, they're able to make your rules and tell you how you have to live. what gave, you know, if you don't have the right to own yourself, what gave these other people the right to own you? And it's interesting that that goes back to, I don't know how far back, to where people would, like kings, would assert that they had that right as some divine right. It came from God, and it was endowed to them. But it's interesting that, like, we don't have that anymore. Instead, now it's like people have, like, come to this illusion. Well, no. We voted on this, and it's like, okay, so basically a group of people who are not you decided that that group of people would have ownership over you. And that was, I guess, some forms of government are more like that, where, you know, a group of people come in and say, yeah, we're going to create this government, we're going to tell people what to do. I mean, arguably, that's, I guess, every government now. But the people still have this illusion that, yeah, but we participated in the election, and therefore we voted for this system, and we want the system. We actually like this system. We just don't like anything that it does. And so we're going to vote harder next time and change things. It's really interesting, but it's kind of like it's a really difficult problem to deal with, because everything you're saying makes complete logical sense if you know to somebody who's able to look at that completely objectively. It all makes sense, but most people who are in the real world are what I like to say, they're in survival mode, right? They're not able to think of these things. They have a public education that has taught them not to think of these things and just to, you know, obey rules and follow things. And so it's almost like the biggest problem we face is that these people are subordinate to this massive system, which means they are now an extension of that massive system, which now makes that system even greater numbers compared to us who are trying to escape that system. It's just a really difficult problem, because we have to in some way figure out, how do we beat this delusion that these people have? Because I like to say the biggest threat we face is not the government itself. It's all of the people who blindly follow it and support it, thinking that the government is there to help us.
Yeah, I mean, it is a big obstacle. I mean, I think one of the problems is it's all we've ever known. You know, it's what we're born into. It's what our parents were born into, and our parents' parents, and our parents' parents. You know, so it's, you know, it's like that whole saying about the only, I'm going to butcher the saying, but something along the lines of the only things that are certain are death and taxes. And I remember the first time I heard that saying, I was thinking, well, why out of all the things in the world, apart from death, which is obvious, would taxes be something that's certain? But that just goes to show how ingrained and how long-running and historical something like taxes. I mean, it's even in the, you know, the biblical stories about, you know, Jesus had to go to Bethlehem because his parents had to pay taxes, you know. And it's, you know, so it goes back that far. And I think the thing is I think there's this kind of illusion of freedom that people have, because there was a time when we were ruled over without any kind of say, you know, without any kind of vote or anything like that. So now that we're in a stage where we have the vote, it's like, ah, now we've got the vote. You know what I mean? It's like, it's kind of like if someone gives you a criminal situation, but there's kind of two parts to it, and they deny you one part, like, oh, well, you could control this, but no, we're going to deny you that. And eventually, through struggle and people gain the right to vote, and obviously that's not for everyone straight away, you know, women and people of different color at different times and stuff like that. But then once people get to that stage, they're like, rah, we've accomplished something, we've got democracy, and we have the power. Yeah, exactly. They kind of champion it as if it's like some kind of victory, whereas all they've got is the same criminal system they had before, but it's just been, they've been given these concessions where it's like, okay, well, you can have a say. I mean, most people know they don't have much of a say anyway, but more to that is they don't question the overall criminal organization. They don't think, well, hang on a minute, I didn't like being ruled over by like a single dictator or whatever it would have been in the past. Why do they don't suddenly think, well, how come a democratic majority all of a sudden should have that right to rule over me? You know, it's kind of like when we abolished slavery or any kind of crime that we recognize as crime, whether it's rape, murder, theft, people, you know, it's like there's a little glimmer of the principle. People are recognizing the principle, but they're not stepping back and seeing that the principle's not being applied consistently. You know, when we abolish slavery, the whole premise of that is because you don't get to own people as property because people have right over themselves as self-owning individuals. It's like, well, okay, well, then you don't get to rule them either. You don't get to tax them. You don't get to tell them what drugs they put in their body and all the rest of it. You know, it's like once you've got one thing, it's kind of like just showing people the principle, because a lot of this morality we already have. You know, if I speak to people on a person-to-person basis and you talk about the non-aggression principle, they might not have heard of the non-aggression principle, but they're familiar with the idea and the concept of, yeah, I have right over me, I don't have right over you, and I shouldn't hit you and I shouldn't steal and all, you know, it's kindergarten stuff. You know, it's stuff that we learn at an early age, but we've grown up in a society where we kind of only have that applied in person-to-person relationships, and we kind of have this blind spot with the government where we kind of think they're exempt, or we just don't even recognize that they're doing something that if it was you and me doing, we would recognize it as a crime. So that's part of what all voluntarists do, not just myself, but, you know, people like yourself as well. One of the things that we're all trying to do is try to wake people up to this principle, wake people up to this idea of saying, look, you own yourself, and so does everybody else, owns their own self. So all of this ruling business, whether it's democratic, whether it's dictatorship, republic, whatever, it's got to go. We can have these systems in a voluntary system. You know, I'm not against democracy as a decision-making tool amongst voluntary collectives. You know, there's businesses and shareholders that run that way. That's all fine. But as soon as it becomes a ruling authority where, whether it's a group of people or an individual person that says, I have the right to tell you what to do when you're not harming others, that's when we need to draw the line. And part of this whole making the non-aggression principle law idea is about drawing that line very explicitly and very clearly, so there's no kind of, you know what I mean, so it doesn't get slipped under the radar and it doesn't get kind of forgotten about. So it's front and foremost. The defining quality of our society needs to be everyone owns themselves, and then we go from there.
Right. It's I was thinking when you first started that out, you're talking about how you know we're given just like, oh yeah, you're given the right to vote, and like, okay, yeah, so now you're free. I'm just thinking of, because we were talking about crime before that, like, imagine a bank robbery. Like, this would be a great movie. There's like, it's like the great bank heist. They go into the bank, you know, they've got the guns and everything, and there's like 30 hostages. And so they tell the hostages, you know, oh, well, we're very democratic people, so we're going to let you vote to decide who gets to live and who gets to die, because we have to release some hostages, right? So we'll let you guys vote on that. And so, like, instead of like focusing on the bank robbery, the whole movie, the whole focus is just on the people arguing over who gets certain rights to certain things. Or maybe they even say, like, yeah, and you know what? We'll even give $10,000 to every hostage that we release. So now people are sitting there arguing, like, yeah, we have the power to vote. Yeah, we're awesome. We're gonna get free money. We get to decide how we live our lives, who gets to live, who gets to die. And ultimately, it's exactly like what you said. It's yeah, but they're totally distracted. They're so focused on this idea of the democracy and the voting, about how voting is fair and democracy is fair, that they're not paying any attention to the bank robbery that's going on at the same time. But another thought that entered my head is, you know, you have, okay, we talk about voluntary systems, and especially with corporations and agreements, right? And this one's always been kind of difficult, because you have HOA agreements, right? So let's say you buy a house that's in a community and there's an HOA agreement. Now, yes, you could buy houses that aren't in HOAs, but there are supposedly sometimes legitimate purposes for this. You maybe you have a I lived in an area that had like a park that was part of the community with a pool and everything else, and so your HOA goes to pay for that, and it wasn't a whole lot of money. But you could, of course, always have you know, that organization, maybe it goes rogue, maybe at some point you're like, you know what, I don't like what this organization is doing, I don't want to participate in that, I don't want access to maybe the park and the pool that they, you know, that's theirs, but I want to withdraw from this. What's really interesting about that is, even though the HOA is a voluntary agreement. Anybody who enters into it does so voluntarily. There's arguably a little bit of coercion when you say, you know, oh, I'm going to sell my house, and then you have to sell it to somebody, and you tell them, yeah, well, if you buy this house, you have to sign this contract, although they still have the option to not buy that house, right? So it's still voluntary, even though I can see how some people say it's a little coercive. But at the end of the day, what's really missing from these is an exit strategy. What happens at what point, you know, at some point when you say, yeah, I don't want to deal with this anymore? And it's interesting too, because this goes all the way up to government, like big government, right? We have the United States, which was founded on, you know, we're going to become independent from the government. They wrote a document that said, it is our right when the government does not serve us that we have the right to alter or abolish it. And so they, for all intents and purposes, abolished it, or at least, you know, abolished it within their geographic region. But then they created another one. And when they created that one, they created all kinds of systems to say, this is how it's going to work. And if you want to change the Constitution, if you want to add a new amendment, this is how you do it. This is the process. But never once did they write down the rules that say, if one of those states wants to leave the union, where's the exit clause? If an individual says this government no longer serves me, or what if people want to just completely dissolve the entire United States government? Where is the exit clause for that? Where's the ability to say that? So going back to the HOA, I think it would be really interesting if people started to think like this and to put pressure on, because usually, I mean, nowadays it's like, you know, some development company is going to buy a huge plot of land. They're going to start breaking it into lots. They're going to create the HOA, and they're going to start selling the houses along with it. So the HOA is kind of already there when you buy this house. But if people were to start putting pressure to those organizations to say, there's going to be an exit clause. If at some point you say the economy crashes, or, you know, whatever, and we're like, yeah, you know what, it's just not worth it to pay this HOA anymore. We're just not going to pay for it. And there can be no legal consequences where they can't come and take your house or put liens on it or anything like that. We have to start, we have to recognize, you know, it's like the think globally, act locally thing. Like, this is a very local way that we can start to think about that type of thing. Because if we can't, you know, if we can't figure that out in our neighborhoods, we're definitely never going to figure that out in the big picture, with something as big as the government. So, I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I would push back a little bit on the idea that there's coercion involved with a homeowner agreement, because, you know, it is an agreement. You know, I mean, like you say, right. No one's forced. I mean, the thing, you know, it's like I mean, normally when we sell property, we just sell property. If I sell something to you, you buy it, and then it's yours, and whatever you do with it is up to you. But if we wanted to make a contractual agreement where we said, okay, part of the agreement of me selling to you is that you also agree to these terms, like a homeowner agreement, I don't see anything wrong with that. That's an agreement that you have the right to enter. Yeah. And obviously, if you violate that, then you're violating contract, you're violating your agreement, and whatever penalties are involved would be something that you should obviously include in the agreement. You know, like if I mean, one example someone gave to me was like about kind of like indentured servitude, and like, you know, if you had a debt, what would you be able to sell yourself into slavery and stuff like this? And I mean, the way I define slavery is it's kind of oxymoronic to say sell yourself into slavery, because slavery is a violation of your self-ownership, and to sell yourself into anything you need self-ownership. So, but you know, you get the idea of what they're saying. And I'm saying, okay, well, yeah, you can do that. Let's say you had a debt and you said, okay, well, I'm gonna make myself your, for want of a better word, slave for the next month to pay off this debt. And then after 2 weeks, you think, do you know what? No, I don't want to do this. Well, you still own yourself, really, because you can't really truly sell yourself, because you're always going to be yourself. But you have made a contractual agreement with the person. So if you break it, then obviously you violated that contract. And at the very minimum, the debt that you owe, that you're obviously, you know, doing this agreement to pay off, would still be owed, because the agreement you made to pay it off, you haven't followed through with. So it's not like it's not like people can ever really 100% lose their rights. But when we make agreements with people, if we violate that, then that is obviously a violation. Relatively small level, because it's dealing with property rather than kind of severe harm. I mean, that's the other thing with the non-aggression principle. Obviously, there's gradients of violations. You know, if I steal a penny off a millionaire, I have stolen. That's still a non-aggression principle violation. But that's much less severe than me stabbing him to death, you know. So so everything's kind of relative. But yeah, but technically speaking, if you made an agreement, then you have to honor that agreement. That's, you know, that's part of contracts. But obviously, with regards to breaking agreements and kind of whatever penalties are due, that's something that you need to negotiate explicitly as part of your contract. Because the problem with contracts, and this is something that's already part of contract law now, is whenever there's any ambiguity in a contract, the benefit of it always goes to the person that didn't draw up the contract. So if you didn't make it clear enough in your contract over something, then that's kind of your fault, and the benefit of the gray area would go to me because I didn't draw up the contract. So, if that
right.
makes sense.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I guess the issue I'm trying to address is people not having the foresight, because when you're dealing with an HOA, it is something like a government. It can change, right? People can vote and they can create new rules. And if you are, if you say, okay, I blindly agree, you know, to follow and have every single one of these rules enforced upon me. And then some people decide, well, we're going to vote and we're going to change those rules. Of course, obviously, if they change the rules and say we're allowed to steal from you now, that's you know, that violates the non-aggression principle. They don't have that right to vote in the first place. But let's just say they vote to raise their fees and they raise them and they raise them and they raise them. You're absolutely right that you made the agreement and you have, you know, you're bound to that contract. Of course, there is the concept of an unconscionable contract where, you know, yeah, well, I never agreed to sell my soul. That wasn't in there, but it says everything, you know. There's that kind of idea. But I think ultimately it's maybe just what I'm getting at is just that it would be a great lesson for people to learn to have that foresight that no matter how simple this agreement might be at the time you sign it, it can change, and you always need to have an exit strategy. So when that thing does change into something you don't like anymore, you need to have a way out. And they have this, right? They have, like, you know, sometimes they'll say if you get a rental agreement, right? They'll say, so you get a rental agreement for 12 months. If you want to leave before the 12 months is up, you just pay an extra month of rent. No big deal. Some people will look at that as a penalty. Other people will look at that as, no, it's buying your way out of a contract. I think either way, it's fair to say that, like, okay, yeah, but it doesn't matter. It's an exit strategy because it's and this is something it's common. It comes up a lot. People are like, yeah, my job moved, you know, all these other reasons. I don't need to stay here for 12 months, and you're only 3 months into a 12-month contract. It would be insane for somebody to be forced to pay the other 8 months, 9 months to this contract when they're not going to be living there, and when the landlord's probably going to rent it out to somebody else as soon as you're out anyways. So it's like so many people have been through that it's like, okay, yeah, we'll make an exit strategy, and that's there. It's common. And I think we need to start thinking more in terms of that with everything that we have, with every agreement that we make. We should start thinking about, you know, maintaining our ownership of our of the options that we have for ourselves in the future, by knowing that we can cancel any agreement and that they're not. I mean, an agreement is an agreement, but, you know, if I don't need this thing anymore, I just want to make sure I can cut it off without huge penalties.
Yeah, no, I agree. And people need to take a bit more care in regards to what they're agreeing to ahead of time. The point I was making with regards to the ambiguity clauses in contract law was just really because that slightly protects them from that a little bit. Like when you were saying about things like, oh, well, what if, you know, people start putting up their prices and changing things like that? Well, unless that was explicitly agreed in your contract, they would be classed as being in violation of the contract, and you wouldn't be obligated to it anymore. So it's that's why that ambiguity thing is quite important, because you can't slip loads of stuff in the fine print very easily, because if it's not explicitly agreed as part of the contract, then, like I say, any ambiguity always goes in favor of the person that didn't draw it up. I mean, this is kind of, I think part of that is to prevent people from trying to slyly get people to agree to stuff they don't really agree to. And that's right that it should be done that way, because obviously consent requires an understanding to what you're consenting to. So I can't say, oh, you know, agree to this deal where, you know, for 12 months I'm going to supply your phones and it's going to cost this much. But like in some kind of fine print that you didn't really read or whatever, I'm going to say this may be subject to change. Well, the only thing you agreed to was that standard contract, and the subject to change thing and all the rest of it, really, if I start changing the terms that you explicitly agreed to, then I can't kind of say, oh, well, you know, I had to, yeah, but you explicitly agreed to these terms. And anything that falls outside of that, then you would have to make explicit to me again for the contract to count. So certain right. things I think people would be protected from, only to a certain extent. I mean, if they agree to stuff and they did agree to it, I mean, it's a little bit like the penalty thing. Like, for example, if you've done a contract and it was explicit in there that if you cancel before the 12 months is up, you have to pay a month in a, like, you know, a month arrears or penalty or however you want to characterize it. Now, if that's explicit in the contract, then and you broke contract and you didn't want to pay that, then I could make the claim that you owe me that money because, you know, you've made that explicit agreement. And, you know, but if that wasn't explicit in there, then I can't make the claim to it. I say, well, yeah, but you can't be wrong. Yeah, but you didn't put anything in here about penalties if I cancel or anything like that. But that's why the onus is always on the person that draws up the contract to make it as thorough as it needs to be for what they want the agreement to be. And they can't, any ambiguity that they put in there will only bite them in the ass coming, you know, down the line. It won't bite the person that didn't draw up the contract in the ass as likely to anyway. But yeah, the other point you make is important, because people need to get out of that mindset of being victims. We need to kind of take hold of the situations we want. You know, if you want to live in an area that has different rules to the homeowner association on the property that's being offered to you, then you need to either negotiate different rules with that property before you enter into the contract. You know, don't enter into contracts that the terms you don't like. You know, people need to take responsibility for themselves in that regard. But the other thing is people need to take control and say, okay, well, if they won't negotiate and if that's their term, we won't buy from there. And we'll, you know, people need to create their own, we need to do a little bit more as people and not be such victims to everything. I know some of it is put on us, you know, through government coercion, which is what I'm trying to get rid of, but we still have personal responsibility. And, you know, like I say, if I can't, for example, I can't move into a house in the middle of the city and then moan about the fact that I live in the city. Well, I that's the choice I made. If I want to live by the sea, then I need to buy a house by the sea. And if I can't, you know, that doesn't mean, you know, we can't afford it and stuff like that. But that's the general thing. We can't say, oh, well, I don't like these homeowner agreements. Well, why did you buy the house under those terms then? You know, if you didn't like those terms, then you should have negotiated different terms or not bought the property at all, or, you know, or whatever the thing is. It's like, I bought this car. Like, let's say you buy a red car, but the person says you've got to keep it red. You've got to sign this agreement. You're not allowed to paint it any other color. Well, if you don't want to have to be held to that, don't sign that agreement. And if he won't sell you the car without signing that agreement, he doesn't have to. It's his property. And until he sells it to you, he can, you know, make any kind of conditions he wants. Once he sells it to you, then it's your property and you can do what you want with it, unless you made an agreement otherwise. But again, if you made an agreement otherwise, if I had that thing with you, I need to explicitly put in that contract what the penalty would be if you did. And I could even perhaps something put as severe as you have to give me the car back or something, whatever it is, you know what I mean? But what I'm saying is I would have to make it explicit what it is you're agreeing to. I can't kind of slip things under the table that you don't notice, because that violates the whole idea of consent. I hope I didn't go on too much with that. It made sense, but yeah.
I know it's difficult not to just keep going on. That's all really great points. I wanted to say this because, you know, you brought up the point about buying a car and not being able to paint it red. That's actually like a real situation where you have, so many different ways you can, you know, somebody sells a property and they're like, yeah, but it's historical, it's meaningful to me. I want to sell this to you. Or maybe they sell it to like, you know, some sort of, or put it in a trust or like sell it to like a, you know, some sort of organization that's going to take care of it. And they say, you know, yeah, just don't tear the house down and build a new one. Like, this is, you know, your thing. You can live in it. You can do whatever you want, but you have to keep that. Like, that's a real thing. And at the same time, it's really interesting. And I know, you know, nobody lives forever. So it's not like you can always be there to protect something. But I think, you know, passing something in that way with a contract is kind of, you know, the best way you can find to preserve something. And, you know, at some point, it might be that, you know, maybe you can't find somebody who's willing to sign that and you just got to sell it and let it go.
Sometimes you get like some rich person who'll buy something and then donate it to a museum because he just wanted it preserved. And he'll do exactly what you said. He'll donate it, but under the condition that they do precisely that they preserve it. But then you'll get other people that want to retain a bit more control than that condition. So they won't actually donate it to the museum. They'll buy it and it'll be their property, but they'll let the museum display it. And so again, you'd have that choice. You could say, well, I don't quite want to give up property of it. You know, I want them to look after it and take care of it, but I might want to change my mind, or I might want to pass it to my kids or whatever. So they might retain ownership, and that's often the situation. A lot of museums hold stuff that they don't own. There'll be some person who owns it, but they're putting it on display because that's what they wanted it for, but they also wanted to retain ownership. Whereas you get other people that will just completely donate it to the museum and say, I trust you, that's yours now. But there will be either implicitly or explicitly, if it's done through a contract, that understanding that they're going to look after it and they're not going to smash it up or sell it or whatever
right.
doesn't want done with it. So yeah, and this is the beauty of a voluntary society is all of these things, all of these little trappings that people worry about losing from our current society that they associate with government. I think we need to kind of wake up and realize we don't need to lose any of that. Because as long as it's all done within the realms of respecting self-ownership, in other words, as long as it's all done with voluntary interactions, we can have all of these things. You know, people can set terms. We can have, like people talk about, I mean, the homeowner association, I think that's an important thing. Because some people talk about, well, you know, they worry about the non-aggression principle as law being very basic. And they think, well, what about, you know, family values? What if I want to live in an area that's got, you know, certain rules that go beyond the non-aggression principle because I want to live? Well, you can have all that through homeowner associations and property agreements and rental agreements and all of those things that we talked about. And none of that's coercive. None of that's violating self-ownership because it's all done with the agreement of the people involved. So, but then at the same time, there shouldn't be any law that prevents another little community that wants to create their little nudist colony where they will have sex out in the open and inject heroin in their arms and whatever else they might do that doesn't violate the non-aggression principle but would offend a lot of people that want to live in more wholesome areas. That's fine. People can segregate in that way. And this is the point about making the non-aggression principle this universal law, because we can still have our little collectives where we have additional rules that go beyond that, you know, because the non-aggression principle is pretty basic and people might have higher standards than simply, you know, don't violate each other. And that's fine. They can do that. But those higher standards, they can only enforce on people that have agreed to be subject to those rules ahead of time. Whereas the whole point of the non-aggression principle is we're saying, look, this applies to everybody. It doesn't matter whether you agree. We don't need a rapist to sign a contract with us for us to use force against someone to stop them from raping. You know, it's a crime. We recognize it as such, and we go from there.
Right. Yeah, and it's also interesting too. I mean, even now, there's a lot of voluntarism, to some degree. I would. It's kind of difficult to say, but let me give some examples. So, like, a lot of contracts you have in the fine print, it says something like, you know, this contract shall be governed by the laws of the state of blah, 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 blah. And so basically what that means is, you know, so let's say you make a contract with a renter, or you're renting, you're the renter, you're the landlord, whichever side, you have a contract, and the place where the property is that's going to be rented, there might be laws in place that say, you know, certain things, like you have to give 30 days notice for vacating and all this other stuff, and that stuff might be in the contract, But whether or not it's in the contract, the fact that it says and you know all of the laws of the state of whatever are going to apply, that's basically it's like the contract, but it's a bunch of other government rules that are built into the same contract. If you were to get rid of the government completely, you could just as easily write all those things right into that contract. One of the difficult things is that when you have the government do that, you can't necessarily change some of those rules. So in some places, for example, you know, let's say, you know, hey, can I rent this place from you? And you know, you really want to rent this apartment. And the guy's like, no, you know what? I had some really bad experiences with renters. And I know the laws here, you know, I can never kick you out if I don't like what you're doing to the place. If you're playing loud music in the middle of the night, I can never kick you out. So I'd rather have it empty than rent it to somebody. And you really want to rent it. So you say, okay, you know what? I'll put in the contract that you're allowed to, like, you know, while I'm out, you can lock the door and throw all my stuff out the window. It's totally cool. It's in the contract. You're allowed to do that. And you're now protected against this. But it doesn't work that way because the government's coercive laws will override that contract and say, well, yeah, I know it's in the contract, but it doesn't matter. You can't do that because our laws are, you know, they supersede that. So that actually takes away our right and our ability to have control of these situations and set our own terms. At the same time, it's really interesting that you have things like, I want to say eBay is probably a good example where you have this system where people can sue each other over, I mean, you know, people can, you know, disputes will arise, you know, somebody buys something, they didn't get what they ordered, you know, they didn't make the payment on time, all these issues can arise. And in the fine print of their terms and conditions, because eBay doesn't want to get dragged into court for every, you know, of these hundreds of millions of transactions, they say things like, okay, if a dispute arises, we will be the arbiters of these disputes, and we will handle this, and we have a process, we deal with all of it, it's very streamlined, something you can't say about the government's process, but that's the control. And then they can also put things in there like we're indemnified, you can't sue us, you know, all kinds of stuff that they can add into that. And essentially what they're doing is they're building a legal system that is designed to handle disputes without the government. And I think they've, for the most part, they've stayed out of court. They've done a pretty good job at doing that. And it's interesting that they've also done a really good job of making sure that everybody's happy, because they've got so many customers and they understand, we want people, you know, even if they have a dispute and they lose, we still want them on the website. They want them to buy again. We want them to sell again. We want them to be a part of the system. They have that incentive, which the government doesn't have. Like, you know, if the judge gives you a really screwed up deal and says, no, you're both guilty, you both have to pay. You know, there's no incentive for them to make sure other, you know, I mean, yeah, some of them are good people and they want to do the right thing, but sometimes they're just like, I'm sleeping through this thing. I don't want to hear about the story. You know, there's no incentive there. So I think these are all really, really important aspects for everybody to see, that, you know, we do have that power in some ways. We're already exercising part of that. We're already living like that. And if the government were to leave us alone in these areas, it really wouldn't be a huge jump to, you know, from where we are to get to that.
Yeah, exactly. And also, using the same kind of thing that you're talking about, is this is how voluntary collectives can work as well. Because, like, a lot of people will say, well, okay, get rid of the government, what do we do? You know, like, what happens to all that infrastructure? What happens to all of those resources and stuff? I mean, obviously, there's certain things that can be returned to rightful ownership and stuff like that, but there's obviously a whole mess of stuff that can't be. And we've got all this infrastructure and everything that's built up, and, you know, national resources and what have you. And I would say, okay, well, like, for example, if this whole thing happened and the non-aggression principle was established as law tomorrow, what would happen tomorrow? Well, nothing would have to change like that, because everything could carry on, but the government would no longer be able to exist as a ruling government, because obviously ruling governments are illegal. So it would have to operate as a voluntary collective, which means any rules beyond the non-aggression principle, obviously, which everyone has to abide by, but any rules beyond that, that like this voluntary collective that was once a government wants you to adhere to, would have to be done with your consent. So you can say, well, I don't want to be part of that, and that's your free choice. It's like I say, it's I mean, I always kind of particularly if I'm talking to people of a left-wing persuasion, one of the things I kind of leave with when I'm kind of really trying to sell this idea to them is I talk about, look, this is equal rights. This is true equal rights, because the only right that we all have is over ourselves. Like when you said about like people having a contract between them, and then the government steps in and says, oh, no, no, we don't care what this contract says. We are saying this. It's like, well, they don't have the right to do that. You know, like that comes, the whole problem with that, and the problem with so many problems in our world, is it all comes from government claiming a right that they don't have, a right to override your consent, a right to interfere with voluntary interactions between consenting adults. They don't have that right. So if we kind of, like I say, establish this non-aggression principle law, what we're doing is we're basically just declaring everybody owners of only themselves. And we're doing it on a societal level. You know, like I say, when we abolish slavery, it doesn't mean, like I say, another important point, so I know all over the place. One other important point I'd like to make as well, because people always say, oh, well, you know, well, what if people still disobey the non-aggression principle law? Well, people disobey laws now. Having a law against rape doesn't guarantee that no one will ever be raped. But what it means is that will be recognized as a crime. So when slavery was abolished, from then on, slavery was recognized as a crime on a societal level, whereas prior to that, it was deemed something as an acceptable thing to do and legitimate. So, you know, this is the idea. It's not saying, we're not guaranteeing that no crime will ever be committed. We're saying that as a society, we're all going to be on the same page over what is and isn't a crime, because it's not going to be defined by some ruling authorities, which is one of the reasons why we have different laws in different countries, because you've got different ruling authorities deciding on different laws. I know there's a lot of similar laws, but there's obviously different ones. This is the whole idea. We're saying, look, you know, the law isn't based on anyone's opinion. It's based on the idea of self-ownership. If we agree on self-ownership, then everything else follows on as implicit. And although we still have those fuzzy edges, which I think can be dealt with by drawing our lines in the sand that, you know, separate the gray areas from the black and white. But once we do that, we have that equality of rights. So people can make whatever, and the eBay thing's a very good example. But also I'd say, in addition to that, it shows how voluntary collectives can work. Because all of these people that say, well, I want to, like, regulated markets is another good example. We can, like, a lot of people say, well, I want a regulated market. That's fine. You can have one. You can still have a regulated market. But the only difference would be is, in a free society, you wouldn't have to use the regulated market. People would have a choice. They could trade unregulated. And obviously there's risks involved in that, because although people can't, you know, actually aggress against them and violate the non-aggression principle, there's still a lowering of consumer standards that you would have in a, you know, in a regulated system. You'd have extra consumer protections, extra standards, and what have you, conflict resolutions, all of these things, like with the eBay system. I mean, eBay is like its own little self-contained regulated market just for itself. But you could do that on a grander scale like we have now. We could have the regulated market exactly as we have it now, but the difference is the unregulated market, or the black market as it's called now, would no longer be criminalized. People would be free to use it or not use it, depending on their preference. And then what you'd likely get is a scenario where people that are trading, you know, if you're going to buy vegetables off the local guy who grows that down your allotment, he doesn't need to be a registered company. You're going to happily buy vegetables off him without him going through a thing. But if you're going to buy something off an international corporation, then you probably are going to want to go through a regulated supplier, because you don't know these people and you're not going to trust them without that additional consumer protections and what have you that you get with a regulated system. So it's like, I often think, particularly when ANCAPs talk about, like, you know, free market, stuff like that, which I've got no problem with. I mean, I've got no beef with ANCAPs, but sometimes they talk about, like, that's the only way. Everyone's got to become a capitalist. We've got to reject all regulation. We've got to reject all kind of anything other than a non-aggression principle. And I'm like, no, the whole idea of the non-aggression principle is that's the only thing that we have to adhere to. And everything else is down to us. And all of these people, particularly of left-wing persuasions, that want socialized organizations, that want, like, you know, again, as long as it's non-coercive, as long as it only involves willing participants and doesn't violate self-ownership in any way, you can have voluntary collectives, you can have voluntary socialism, for want of a better word. I know people will be screaming, that's an oxymoron, but I think they know what I'm talking about. Take the government coercion out of socialism, and what have you left with? A lot of people say, oh, you've still got something that won't work. Maybe not, but the people that will pursue that will be the people that choose to, and it won't be forced on you. And then if those systems do flourish in a free society, they'll do so based on merit, because they do work. And then, you know, and that's the true test of whether something works or not, because you can't test it in a government system where you're being forced to use it or not. You know, like people say, well, this works. Well, just only because people are forced to use it, if they had a choice, it might all crumble. And that's what a lot of ANCAPs will probably think about a lot of socialized systems, but that's fine. But then there's a lot of people that will, there's a lot of people on the kind of left wing of that will say, well, we don't trust the free market to be the magic savior of everything. We think we need some collectives. We think we need to provide this to, you know, and all that. And that's all fine, as long as everybody on each side of that conversation recognize self-ownership, as long as we've got that universal common ground, then every kind of economic system and every kind of way of life can be pursued and we can all live in peace. And also, one other thing is, I think while we've got the choice to not be together, I think we're more likely to negotiate together. It's like, if you've got the choice to walk away, then you're more likely to actually sit down and listen to what the other person says, to think about whether you may want to work with them or not, because there's no gun in the room, you know? Whereas, you know, you know that you're free to leave. Whereas when people are forced together, they don't want to be together, even if it's something that they may potentially be open to in a voluntary situation, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a lot.
Sorry.
it's great. It's all true. My lights are flickering here if my power goes out. I don't think I put the battery backup back in. But it really is true. And especially, you know, one thing that I've really been focusing on a lot with my campaigns and my counter propaganda is that it's kind of that thing, right? Because we have this fight between capitalists and socialists, and at the end of the day, it's like yeah, you guys can really just do whatever you want. And it's almost like I think I've come to the point where the capital is not the problem, the social isn't the problem, it's the ism. The ism is like when you like say, oh yeah, this is the system we're gonna have, it becomes the ism, and everybody's gonna be forced to live under it. And I think that's really where it gets crazy, because you can have social systems or capital based systems that work. And you know, like I talked to one guy. He called himself an ANCOM, and you know, he was talking about, you know, his perfect idea of like what his commune would look like. And I was like, yeah, but like, you know, you're talking about having like 50 people there. You're not going to have people who know how to manufacture computer parts. So you're not going to have internet or communication or things like that with other places. And he's like, no, we would just trade with other places that are capitalist to get the things that we need. So it's like, even like as an ANCOM, he still respected the AN side of that word, by saying like, yeah, we're not going to force people into this commune. We're not going to force everybody else to live this way. This is our preferred method. Hopefully it works. You know, nobody knows what the future looks like for anything. But you know, if we need to, we will trade with people outside, but collectively within our commune, we're going to live a certain way. And I was like, I cannot as a voluntarist object to that. I can't tell you, no, don't do that. You have no right. Like it's all voluntary. And I think that's something that like we all really need to, like, I like as much as I know it, it's still like it creeps up in the back of our heads. Like it's something we all kind of need to learn and relearn and relearn and just always have there. And that's I think the core of the voluntary spirit.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we have over here in England, we've got socialized healthcare. We have the NHS, National Health Service. And funnily enough, whether it's because we've had it for quite a while and people are used to it, but it's one of those things that's quite unanimously supported. You know, even left and right wing, even people on the right wing like their socialized healthcare in England, particularly prefer it when we look over the pond to the American system. Now, the problem with both the American system and our system in England, again, is the government coercion, the vastly inflates medical costs and creates, and particularly in our system. I mean, as much as you'll struggle to find anyone in England who doesn't want the NHS, but you'll also struggle to find anyone in England who doesn't also say that the NHS is in big trouble, that it's bloated with corruption and bureaucracy, as well as being underfunded in other areas and all of this. But that all comes from the coercive aspect of it. The reason why you have bureaucracy in government, and the reason why you have corruption in government, is because they're dealing with stolen money, is because they're dealing with a system that people don't have a choice about whether they're a part of it. So I'm quite confident, and I'd love to obviously create a free society so I can see whether I'm right or not, but I'm quite confident that if we created a free society here in England, I think we would keep our NHS. It would obviously be a non-coercive version where everyone would be able to cash out of it and say, I don't want to be part of this, and that's fine, they don't have to be. But obviously the consequence of that might be that they don't get to use the services of it, that, you know, and they, if they want to go private, then they have to go private and stuff like that. That's fine. But the point is a system like that, I mean, I think some people might look at both systems, if you got rid of government, both the American system and the English system would improve because you get rid of that coercion. So, like, for example, a true free market private system in America, the cost of drugs and stuff comes down because you've got that competition, you get rid of all of the licenses and patents that drive pharmaceutical costs up, you get rid of the drug war. I mean, cannabis prohibition is a big thing that would drive it down because that would replace a lot of medicines and stuff like that, you know. So there's all these things that would happen that would improve both systems, whether you've got an actual free market where people are just going through private providers and basically doing their own thing with regards to the healthcare, or whether you've got like a more socialized system like in England where we're all part of this national health service that we all kind of contribute to, then, and that provides for all of us, including those of us that can't even afford to contribute to it. But the thing is if that started working in a way that wasn't working for us, or in a way that we didn't want it to, we would have that control because we wouldn't have to be part of it. We would actually be true owners of it. Like if you're a shareholder of a company, you can cash out at any time and say, I don't want to be part of this anymore because it's not running the way I want it to, and because I'm only one member of many people that are equal owners of it, I don't get to dictate how it goes, and I'm being outvoted, so I'm going to cash out and I'm not going to contribute to it anymore. And that's fine. But again, coming back to that thing about when you've got the right to walk away, your power to negotiate terms that do fit what you want work much better. And just to give you an example, here in England, if I was cannabis is a perfect example, that's obviously not available on the NHS, or there is a version of it that's like a patented pharmaceutical that kind of super expensive and not very good and all that. But you know, if I say they're not providing me this medicine, so I can say to you, okay, right, you've got a simple choice: either start providing this or I'm no longer going to be part of the NHS and you're going to lose me as a part owner and a customer. And that will be my power. I'd have that power to walk away. And simply from having that power, I've got more chance of influencing this organization to actually work in a way that I want it to, because I've got that power to walk away. So again, whether it's a socialized system or like a private system, and again, when I say socialized, for people that are listening, I'm not talking about government socialized, I'm talking about, you know, a voluntary collective. Either way, having that freedom allows us to have a system that actually works for us.
Yeah, and you bring up a really good point when you talk about walking away. I remember reading books on negotiation, and like the most powerful tool is the ability to walk away. And it's like, and I thought this was like, okay, yeah, like, you know, because they always use examples of the car dealership. You walk into the car dealership, and, you know, you ask them for a lower price, they don't lower the price, and you say, okay, fine, I'm going to leave. Well, I tried this, and I was like, okay, I'm going to leave, and I left, and they just let me walk out. but what was interesting was, you know, because, like, this is, of course, in LA, where it's like they don't care. They probably go through so many cars, they just don't care. But I took a trip to China where, you know, in the U.S., like, everywhere you go, anything you want to buy, the price is on the thing, and you can't haggle, you can't negotiate or anything. But in China, it's really interesting that, you know, pretty much all the shops you go to, it's, you know, how much is that? They'll give you a price, and then you say, no, I'm not interested, and you walk away, and they start lowering the price, and they say, no, I really don't want it. And it's really interesting, because if you really just don't want it, like, oh, that was interesting, but I don't, like, I would never buy this. I would never want this in my house. I just thought it was interesting to look at it for a minute. they think you're interested. They think you want to buy it. If they can get the price down low enough, you will buy it. And so they take walking away as a negotiation. Okay, fine, I'll lower the price. It's really amazing. But this is also really interesting because I've been trying to, I guess, find the right words to describe this, but our labor market, you know, we are forced to work because we have a high cost of living. We can't own our homes because we have to continuously pay property tax on them. Through generations, that's been taken away from us. So even those who had property in their family generations ago, you are now forced to rent. If you, they say like, oh, America has the highest property ownership ever. Yeah, but nobody actually owns that because you're paying a mortgage and you're paying property tax on top of that. You just have it in your name. But it's, at the end of the day, you need to get the coin to pay the king just to exist. And because of that, you need to go to get a job. And what's interesting is your ability to walk away. Before all these taxes were there, you could literally walk out into the woods, squat somewhere, build a cabin, catch fish out of a river, you know, catch your own food, grow your own food, whatever you want, and live your life perfectly happy without having to get a job. But all of these taxes said, well, yeah, you can still do that, but you have to pay a tax, which means you have to go into a job and work. So while that is not a glamorous lifestyle, and a lot of people enjoy working for having, you know, all these luxuries that they have in a city, the fact that they have taken that away means that they have taken away your ability to walk away. So when you walk to a job, you need that job. And you say, yeah, I want to work. And they say, well, we'll give you $5 an hour. And it's like, yeah, but that's so low. If you could just walk away, and if everybody that walked through that door and they offered $5 to walked away, at some point they'd say, oh man, these people are just walking away. I might have to offer them more. But if you're in there and you say, I can't walk away because I got to pay the king his property tax, then you are stuck. And this, it seems completely unrelated because it's a voluntary, like we say, it's a voluntary contract when you walk in to get your job. Like, yeah, but you agreed to work for this amount. Yeah, but you agreed to work for this amount because your negotiating power was taken away by the government. So it's really interesting. It is still a voluntary agreement, but the pretext is completely coercive. And it's not the employer's fault. I mean, unless it's like a huge employer that's like been bribing politicians. Yeah, up the taxes so I can get cheaper labor. Who knows? Maybe. But yeah, I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, with like you say, it's one of the reasons why I find the minimum wage argument so frustrating, because it's kind of like they missed the point. They missed the point that the reason why companies get away with paying such low wages to people is because, as you say, it is voluntary. I mean, I work a job, I hate it, the wages are too low. So it's kind of, but it is still voluntary because no one put a gun to my head. And all of the kind of coercive elements, if you like, are just laws of nature. Like, I need to feed myself. That's a, you know, it's no one else's fault that I need to feed myself. And as you say, so like my employer didn't have any part in the coercion. But the simple fact of the matter is I have such a low level of negotiating power because there's plenty of other people who's desperate enough for work that will, you know, that are all vying for it and all the rest of it. And it's almost a little bit like when people that would call themselves maybe ANCOMs or people of a left-wing persuasion that are very anti-capitalist, one of the things I sort of say to myself, like, well, in a way, you're kind of forced to engage in, just like people on the right wing will complain that they're forced to pay for these socialized programs and stuff like that. People on the left wing are forced to engage in capitalism in ways that they might not want to, because the people that might want to create their own little commune can't, because again, they'd have to pay property taxes and they'd have to pay. So even if they wanted to create a moneyless society, they'd still need to have some kind of money earning potential as a community to pay the big government that's claiming ownership over everything. So it's like having this giant mafia. In fact, I often talk to people, I always kind of dare them to kind of show me how a government is any different from a mafia in regards to like any aspect of it, really, you know, like the extortion of tax, the all of the we own this, we'll protect you, but you know, we'll use force if you don't pay us and all of that sort of stuff. So it's kind of like, you can kind of say to both sides, look, we're both being forced into stuff we don't want. And that's the point. The commies can have their communes. The cappies can have their free market. People that want little hybrid systems can have their hybrid systems. And we can all negotiate on much better terms. And we might find as well that there are things... It's a little bit like, imagine there was a deal that you wanted. Like if I brought you into a room with another guy, regardless of what the deal is, under a voluntary situation, explain the details to you, you'd be like, yeah, that sounds like a great deal. I'm up for that. Imagine I then, the exact same deal, but instead of bringing you in voluntarily, I bring you in at gunpoint. I say, sign this agreement. I still tell you what it all is. You're going to be resistant to it, even if it's something that you might have otherwise wanted, because someone's forcing you to do it. And it's kind of like if you take that coercion away, apart from the fact that we have the right to walk away from each other, and that's always great, and sometimes that would be the best way to go. Sometimes, you know, we're not all going to, you know, mix and work together, but we can still live in peace because we have that foundation of self-ownership. But the other thing is when we've got that coercion out of the way, all of a sudden, I think we might actually find ourselves negotiating and coming together in ways that we wouldn't have imagined before. And I'll just give you a very quick example of this. I was speaking, because one of the things I try to do is try to show that voluntarism is a neutral thing that's for everybody, not just anarcho-capitalist, but, you know, people, you know, like you could be a voluntary socialist, you could be a voluntary conservative, you could be a progressive voluntarist and all of this. And I was speaking to a guy who identified as a progressive, you know, voted for Bernie Sanders and all of that sort of stuff. And by the end of the conversation, he was basically calling himself a progressive voluntarist. So he hadn't changed his progressive values, but he had come round to the idea of voluntarism. Because I think a lot of people do when you really talk to them, because very few people are going to object to the idea of self-ownership. And if they've got a brain in their head, they can understand the non-aggression principle comes from self-ownership. So it kind of, everything kind of fits into place from there. So I had this conversation with him, and one of the ideas I was mentioning was this idea of these voluntary collectives, and was talking about, you know, how this can provide the sort of socialism that he wants without all of the corruption and bureaucracy that poisons all the social programs that we have provided by government. Anyway, I went through all the details of it with him, and he liked it and thought it was a great idea. The same day, I spoke to an anarcho-capitalist, and I had almost the exact same conversation, explained the exact same thing to him. He also liked it, and I was telling him about my conversation with the progressive and all the rest of it. He also liked it and actually said, yeah, I think I'd be into that. But his only quibble was, as far as he's concerned, it wasn't socialism that I was describing, it was capitalism. So they both liked the same idea, but one of them wanted to call it socialism, one of them wanted to call it capitalism. It's the exact same idea, but the guy that was calling it capitalism was saying, well, that's capitalism because it's free market, it's voluntary. Even though you've taken the profit motive out of it, instead of doing a business model, you've got this collective where everyone's kind of, you know, contributing and looking after each other. But because it's voluntary, that's still free market as far as I'm concerned. That's still capitalism. And I couldn't really argue with him because technically he was right. But then the socialist guy was saying, well, that's socialism because it's a social program. You know, you can't say these people are capitalists, they're not businessmen, they're not making a profit, they're, you know, and all that. And again, he was right. And I was kind of sitting in the middle thinking, well, do you know what? I could give two monkeys whether we call it socialism, capitalism, or whatever. If it's truly voluntary, if it's truly a free society, and both sides actually like the same idea, they just want to call it something different, that's fine. And I could imagine if we ever created a free society, I could imagine a lot of people on the left saying, yeah, this is all we ever wanted. And a lot of people on the right saying, yeah, this is all we ever wanted. And I'm thinking, well, why have you been at each other's throats all this time? It's because we've been having the wrong argument. We've been having this socialism versus capitalism thing when it should have been authoritarianism or statism versus voluntarism or freedom, or however, you know, it's, you know, when you see that political compass where you've got the left and the right and you've got, yeah, the up and the down, it's, for me, it's like, I don't care about the left and the right. I care about the up and the down. Because as far as I'm concerned, I'd happily live in a commune if my rights were respected, just as happily as I'd live in a free market capitalist society if my rights were accepted. But I would reject any kind of capitalism that involves a coercive government, and I would reject any kind of socialism or communism that is a government dictatorship. So that's kind of where I stand on it. And I just think that way, people don't have to abandon all of their values. Like the progressive, he didn't change any values at all to become a voluntarist. He just said, I agree with you. We shouldn't use government coercion. That's wrong. But I still think we should, through voluntary collectives, do this rather than going through sort of typical business models. We should have, like, you know, healthcare program that we all contribute to. And the thing is about it, there are, when you look at it in those contexts, all of a sudden there's a little bit of a selling point, because, you know, like one thing that our National Health Service has over any insurance company that you could have in a private system is we've got massive buying power, because we're an entire nation. You know, so even under a voluntary system, the buying power of a National Health Service, again, without the coercion of government, without the corruption of inflated prices that are ripping us off, all of a sudden healthcare can be brought down. That's why I say, in a free society, healthcare could be so much cheaper, whether it was socialist or capitalist. Either way, it would be vastly improved. Sorry, I went on a bit there.
No, that's great stuff, and that's I mean, that really goes full circle back to what they teach us in school, right? They give us the options. Well, yeah, there's socialism, there's capitalism, there's communism. There's all these isms, and we live in one, and we live in the best one. That's never going to change, but they don't teach you about voluntarism, and I think that's really awesome that a lot of people are hearing that and seeing that not as a threat to, because, you know, that's a socialist hears capitalism and they see it as a threat. A capitalist hears socialism and they see it as a threat, but they hear voluntarism. And yeah, sometimes they're like, but what happens when corporations make their own police departments? You know, they come up with like rules, you know, things that might potentially scare them. But, you know, it's really interesting to see that for the most part, they understand. Yeah, it's much better. Like even with Democrats, I've found a lot, you know, when they object to me saying taxation is theft, the first thing I go to is, well, do you like where your tax money is being spent? And of course, they're always like, no, the bombs, the wars, the corporate bailouts. And no, they hate that stuff. And I'm like, well, if you would stop handing your money over to the government, you'd eliminate all of that, because it's the politicians who are spending all this, spending all your money that way.
When I spoke to the progressive, I made the same point, because I said to him, like, you know, because I was saying, well, look, you don't like a lot, I'm sure, a lot of things, you know, the wars and the police brutality that you're funding, and you shouldn't be forced to do that. But in a free society, you wouldn't be. But at the same time, the right wingers that might not want to fund the healthcare service or the welfare service that you do want to fund, they don't have to. It's just about, I think, and when you put it to people like that, they start realizing, well, hang on a minute, it's just offering everybody the same rights that I want for myself. And it appeals to people's sense of fair play and morality. It's just about bringing it to the surface. It's almost like this hidden principle that we're not illuminating, you know? And I think if we shine a light on this concept, I think we'll be surprised how many people on the left and right are actually more receptive to it than we might otherwise think.
Absolutely. So we are at the end of our show. This has been really amazing. I just want to give you an opportunity, if you have any final thoughts, or if you have any websites or anything you want to plug, here's your opportunity. Go for it.
The project's called Nations of Sanity. I've got a website, YouTube channel, and Facebook page, all called Nations of Sanity. So if anyone wants to check out my work, and just type in Nations of Sanity and you'll find me. Anyone who ever wants to contact me, I really do welcome scrutiny. I mean, part of how I developed the idea was through people, you know, discussions and conversations and people picking out flaws and stuff like that. So I do welcome scrutiny, and obviously I welcome support. And, you know, all of us voluntarists are all kind of fighting the same thing. But I'm really asking all voluntarists to really consider this more specific idea, because I do think it kind of sharpens up the edges of what we're presenting, and certain concerns that people have, like, well, what do we do about the fuzzy edges and stuff like that? I think we can address those issues. So that would be my final thought to people, is just really think about the idea of establishing the non-aggression principle as the law through a peace agreement. Try not to be too scared by the word law, because it doesn't have to mean government dictate. It can mean universal law, terms of peace, however you want to call it. So
right. No one's sitting around trying to overturn the law of gravity. So we can accept a few of them. Awesome. Matt, thank you so much for coming on the show. This is an amazing talk. Definitely going to have you back on to talk more about this. This is great stuff. It's great. I think it really hopefully inspires a lot of people to think and really have these conversations and, you know, spread this information and have these conversations with other people, because ultimately, You know, we live in a society that doesn't understand these things because we've gone through this mass public indoctrination system that has taught us everything we need to know in order to be productive workers or productive slaves or whatever you want to call it. But they haven't really taught us to think about our own existence and, you know, how we should operate with other people in this world and how we can coexist and live peacefully with each other. So thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please make sure to like and share it. If you're watching this on Facebook and YouTube, like, share, comment. If you're on Twitter, you can retweet it. And if you want to get this in the podcast format, we have this on anywhere where you can go get your podcast, Apple, iTunes, Google, everywhere else. Go check it out. Make sure you subscribe. And of course, head over to taxationistheft.info. One thing I guess I really need to mention right now is we're giving away the amazing Opener 3000 on taxationistheft.info. This is something that I know it looks kind of like an AR-15. It's absolutely not. It's just a piece of metal in a funny shape. But it does open a lot of things. And but because the government likes to regulate shapes, there are certain things we had to do to make this happen. But if you head on over to taxationistheft.info, you can check that out. Just look for the amazing Opener 3000. And I will see you guys next time. Taxation is theft. Have a good night.